From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. August 1984 marks the 10th anniversary of Richard Nixon's resignation of the presidency of the United States in the aftermath of the Watergate investigation by Congress. One aspect of Watergate is the subject of a new book by two scholars who recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. Gladys Engel Lang and Kurt Lang are the authors of The Battle for Public Opinion, The President, the Press, and the Polls During Watergate, now available in paperback from Columbia University Press. Gladys Engel Lang and Kurt Lang are sociologists at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. In their book about Watergate, the Langs distinguish between public sentiment or mood and public opinion. They describe public opinion as an identifiable and measurable expression of popular views about controversial political and social issues. In this sense, public opinion is one element that influences the decisions of American political leaders. It's also a manifestation of the preferences of Americans regarding questions of public policy. Here then are Gladys Engel Lang and Kurt Lang, the authors of The Battle for Public Opinion, The President, the Press, and the Polls During Watergate.
What's important about public opinion is that it's a kind of an idea. It's an idea that people have of what people are willing to put up with, what they're willing to accept, what they will definitely revolt against if it's imposed upon them. So you have to think of it as a kind of a shared idea of what would happen if policymakers do thus and thus. And in Watergate, that is exactly, I think, the way we look at public opinion. What you had in Watergate, you had what was unique about it in terms of public opinion there, is that probably you had a larger, but by the time you got about after, certainly after the first few months of Nixon's second term, you had a larger proportion of people who were aware of Watergate and what it was, that there was such an issue, than on almost any issue that had come along. But what happened in the course of the controversy is that it did indeed become a moral issue. It became a symbolic issue, and people were involved in it. But the main point was when it came to the president, they were outraged because politicians might be crooks, but the man in the White House could not be a crook. And I think that in that sense, that it really, people did become the morally indignant in the sense is this is something that was not allowed to go on in the White House. They wanted to believe in their president.
Kurt?
I think an other comment on that is I think they also began to develop the feeling that something could be done about it. But what I like to emphasize that contrary to what many others have said, it is not that the public led in wanting to get Nixon out.
Well, if the public wasn't leading in wanting to get the president out of the White House, then what was the importance of public opinion? Stimulating people who could get him out?
That's right. Giving the people who wanted to get Nixon out, right, a sense that if they were to move ahead, it would be accepted. Because impeachment is a very, very frightening word to people. And you see, one of the reasons we are saying that public opinion does not lead is a public, as a public, cannot act. It cannot formulate a policy. It cannot decide on a procedure and implement it and how to get Nixon out of office. But when the House began to take the lead through its Judiciary Committee to develop articles of impeachment and so on, the public was ready to follow. But the representatives are very cautious. They wanted to make sure that if they moved ahead on this, that it wouldn't cost them the next election. It wouldn't backfire.
Yeah, I want to be sure, too, that we don't talk about people who wanted to get him out. I think the important thing was that after the Senate Watergate hearings and when the tape surfaced, it wasn't just people who wanted to get him out. It was people who wanted to find out the truth. And that was what really became the issue. One of the reasons I think that we were anxious to write this book and to see what actually happened and what role the press played and what role public opinion played, was because of the fact that that after a controversy like this, what happens is that historical or political myths grow up, I think there is gradually beginning to emerge a kind of a myth again that this wasn't anything more than the usual political shenanigans, and that in a sense that the media did drive or help at least to drive Nixon out of office. And I think that everything that that we have been able to tell about it was that I don't know that the press underplayed the story. I think that they played it up more than people give them credit for during the campaign of 1972. It wasn't a story. Nothing was happening very much during the fall. And once you had the court case come up at the beginning of 1973, and I will say once Vietnam, the prisoners of war were home and that was no longer a big story, then certainly from then on the press gave it a very big story. But they let events guide them. They didn't try to overplay it. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've been accused of overplaying it, but we can find no real evidence that they were that they went out of their way to be biased against Nixon. But I just wanted to stress that one point, because I think that I have a sense that we're getting to the anniversary of the 10th anniversary of the Nixon resignation, and that we're going to have a little bit of this now, looking back at it and saying, well, it really wasn't any different than any other controversy. I think that it was, in many ways, the fact that a president was removed, the fact that an unelected president came on, and that the nation really agreed with this. This is the most extraordinary kind of working of American democracy.
It's the closest we've come to the brink.
Right, yeah. And I think it was. It's really it's something that's amazing, and I would not like to see the myth grow up. And I think that was always the idea, that the White House tried to make it into a political battle, and then the legislators and other people tried to depoliticize it.
Right. Gladys Kurt, the name of your book is The Battle for Public Opinion, and the subtitle is The President, the Press, and the Polls. Now, we've been talking about the president here. Tell me about the relationship between the press and the polls. How has that relationship developed in American politics?
Well, polling first, or at least this kind of public opinion polling, what we call public opinion polls, really developed as an adjunct to the press. When Gallup got started, he sold a column to the press, and I'm talking about 50 years ago, or close to 50 years ago.
Just by back now. In the 1930s.
That's right.
Okay. Kurt, let me interrupt you for a moment. What is public opinion polling journalistically? Hard news? Feature stuff? What do the journalists themselves think about it?
Well, I think there's been a bit of a shift, although it's really a question you should address to the journalists.
Uh-huh.
I think it began very much as a sort of column feature type of thing. And over the decades, I really have to say, roughly in the late 60s, they developed a notion of precision news writing. In other words, the press is always criticized for arrogating to itself the role of the public spokesman.
Yeah.
And I think journalists like to play it safe. They like to hide between hard evidence, so to speak. And so gradually they developed this idea, right, that instead of the press having been criticized, you know, for interviewing six people in Kalamazoo or in, you know, Will It Play in Peoria, right, is the old thing, and then they're saying this is what the public thinks.
Mm-hmm.
And so editors becoming increasingly cautious and increasingly objective, in quotes, around that, thought they had a nice instrument in polls. And in following the polls, right, the press of itself created something that wasn't there before. You see, now I think that polls, in fact, have become hard news. In other words, what the public, a statement by the public, as reflected in the polls, is almost as important, let's say, as a statement by the president or the minority leader about what the country or his party thinks.
They create their own news in a way.
Yeah, they do. In other words, that's quite a different. Mm-hmm. I can't say that we have the time here to go into all the implications of that, but that really does mean that they are creating the news and reporting it at the same time.
Well, let's restrict our conversation to Watergate, which is the topic of your book and your investigation into polling and the press at that time. And let's give everybody the benefit of the doubt. How reliable were the polls during that period?
Well, I don't think it's simply a question of reliability. It's more a question, really, of validity.
Uh-huh.
Now, there's one thing that a poll does. It always gives a clearer picture of public opinion than it actually is, right? Mm-hmm. If you read a figure saying the public believes 54% to 33%, let us say that Nixon planned the break-in or that he should be impeached or whatever it is, you know, you get the picture, my God, right? There's a big majority. And you don't know to what extent each of the respondents has thought through the question.
Now, Kurt, let me ask you to stop on a word you just used. You say it clarifies what the public is thinking. Do you mean it oversimplifies? That it gives to public opinion, whatever this beast is, a sort of definition that it doesn't intrinsically have?
But did I use the word clarify?
You said it makes it clearer.
That's
somehow.
Right. It gives it a clarity that it doesn't have. Yeah. It reifies it, right?
Uh-huh.
It gives it an existence. Mm-hmm. It gives an existence to something that's really a much more fluctuating thing. And I think that's one of the problems, or that'd be the first part, but only the first part of my answer when you say is, you know, how reliable are the polls?
Mm-hmm. Gladys?
Well, in terms of reliability, it depends on what's being measured.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, this we can get into that. That's a problem in terms of people knowing how to read the news that's given to them about the polls. But in terms of what Kurt is saying, I think there's a good example in Watergate. In terms of public opinion favoring impeachment, they kept using the word the magic majority. You know, in other words, they were waiting for the point. It was, you know, when 50% of the country, 51%, 50.5%,
yeah,
the magic majority, when they would agree that impeachment was necessary. And that gave it a kind of an authority that made it seem something different than what it was. In terms of impeachment, I mean, one of the things that we show is that at any one time, in terms of the various polls, there was a huge range in terms of the proportion who purportedly were in favor of impeachment. Now, when we looked at that, that has to do with how the question was asked. That makes a big difference. I think you can go back and you can show that if you ask the question, you know, whether they backed what the investigation that the House had started, that there was a majority backing the House Judiciary Committee from the very point at which it began to make its inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
What has happened is that I think we know more about the reliability of polls with regard to voting in presidential elections. I think in the recent nominating process, you see how polling can go off if you have many people who really don't have any idea of who the people are, if they haven't made up their minds and they're asked about whom they favor, in situations like that. And that's true of many attitudes, mm-hmm, that pollsters ask questions about. I mean, people will come up and they'll give an opinion when they don't have any, they really don't have an opinion. This is back to what I said about sentiment and opinion. Sometimes there is what you sense that something is going on, but you really it's hard to pick that up through public opinion polls unless you have someone who really is a real whiz at getting the right question that will really tap people's deepest feelings about that.
Well, let's come back to the question of who makes up the questions, without naming names, I suppose, and without naming polling organizations. How does that process occur?
Well, they read a newspaper, and they say, what's hot? What's newsworthy? And then they sit around and formulate the question, and sometimes it doesn't come out so well. Now, I should also add that there is a distinction between the polls that are normally published in the newspaper and other social surveys that are really conducted more carefully. We have to understand that the Gallup and Harris and the CBS New York Times poll and so forth, I mean, they have to, they're like journalists, right? They have to be there the fastest with the mostest, so to say.
Yeah.
And they try to exercise care, but sometimes they make mistakes. Now, there are other surveys. For example, there is a two-wave survey that is conducted, has been conducted every presidential election by the University of Michigan Survey Research Center. And they work on their questions as much as a year in advance. Now, they don't finalize them. And they are then pre-tested on small samples to ascertain that people really, you know, understand them, that they have some validity. But this is not true, as a rule, of the polls that we read about in the paper from day to day.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a conversation with two scholars who recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. They are Gladys Engel Lang and Kurt Lang, the authors of The Battle for Public Opinion, The President, the Press, and the Polls During Watergate, now available in paperback from Columbia University Press. Gladys Engel Lang and Kurt Lang are sociologists at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. Now, we've been talking about loaded questions and who makes up questions that go into public opinion polls, and our topic is Watergate and the president and the polls, the subject of your book. Speaking of loaded questions, how much of a preconception of this whole thing did you have as you went into the writing of this book? Did you have a goal, for instance? What was your purpose in writing about the relationship of the three? Gladys?
Well, our purpose, as I've said, is that we were fascinated by the fact that what was a controversy that was said to have torn the nation apart, and did appear to be tearing it apart, that it should have turned out to end so quietly. And that seemed to us at the time that no one really was paying attention to that. And just because we are interested in this field, have worked in the field, what we set out to do is say, here's an outcome. This is what happened. We could look and find out that at the very end, that there weren't more than 15, any poll we took, any information we had from any study anywhere, that there were no more than 15% of the people, and that's quite a small number, who in any way felt that somehow or other he should not have resigned. And even some of the 15% still said, well, he had done it, and, you know, he'd gone out like a man. It had been his finest hour. So you had this great unanimity, and we always like to say that there was no time that the nation was united except in wartime, at least in peacetime, as much as when Watergate ended. Now, that's an extraordinary thing. So we had no preconception in terms of it would have been easier if we had wanted to be sensational and come out and say the media drove Nixon out.
In other words, you work backward from the results.
That's right. We work backward from them. Then really got all the data that we could from every possible source, and then tried to figure out just what role the polls and the press had played.
Gladys, tell me specifically about the role of television in what role did it play in Watergate?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you asked me that, because so many people have talked about the role of television in terms of whether it was biased or news coverage was biased or not biased. I don't think it was biased. But I think the most important thing that happened with television is that all the main events of Watergate were actually fought out with live coverage of television, including the Senate Watergate hearings, including the Cox resignation, the House Judiciary impeachment hearings, and then finally the resignation speech. that gave people a sense, not that they were doing it themselves, but that basically that it was out in the open. They saw the process, and they believed when finally, whether they wanted Nixon to resign or not, they believed that the process had been fair.
Do you think in retrospect that the idea that the press, or television specifically, got Nixon, do you think that has currency today?
I think it still has currency, and that's why.
Did it then? How, to what extent? Kurt?
Well, I think mostly to the extent it made things public, mm-hmm. you see, and the people in doing something, right, they insisted on publicity. Mm-hmm. And I think without the presence of television, which disseminated the same image clear across the country, the public would have felt itself much more impotent.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's the whole idea of sunshine laws, and they wanted to get to the bottom of it. And that issue, I think, of wanting to get to the bottom of it would not have had that same impact on them if it had not been for these televised events.
But television came out of the controversy quite well off at that point. I mean, in terms of polls, actually trust in the media at that point had gone up.
You mean, in other words, that people had a higher degree of regard for television?
Immediately after Watergate, uh-huh. at any rate. That went up during Watergate. Am I right on that?
Yes, here? Definitely. Yeah. Everything else went down for a while, you know, mm-hmm. but television and press, too, picked up a bit in terms of trust and confidence, because we have been very much concerned about the decline of trust and confidence in American institutions. And so in this respect, television accredited itself quite well.
Kurt, tell me about the, as Gladys says, the data that you used. What sources, I realize you can't go into them all, but what are the primary things that you looked at in figuring out the relationship between the polls, the press, and the president during Watergate?
Well, it's not too difficult a question to answer. First of all, we looked at all the polls we could possibly get a hold of.
How many are there, just parenthetically, then and now? A dozen or so that people read, or more than that? What?
Well, I think at the time there were few. Uh-huh. I would say that there were about five major polls that allowed us to track impeachment, sentiment on impeachment or other closely related issues.
Okay, so you looked at that, and what else?
Then we looked at the press coverage uh-huh. of it, both newspapers and television.
How did you do that so that you had a sense that what you were looking at was representative?
Well, I'm not sure that...
Or was that one of your interests?
Well, it was one of our interests, uh-huh. but I'm not sure that what we could actually obtain was a representative sample of newspapers. And mm-hmm. so we concentrated on what I would call the national news media. We looked at what the what network TV news did, and we looked at the New York Times, Washington Post, Chicago Tribune, Los Angeles Times, and New Orleans Times-Picayune. The reason for choosing those is that they have indices of their news stories available.
But we also, we made use of every study that any social scientist, any place, or journalist had done along the line.
You were covering your tracks, in other words.
We were covering our tracks as close as we could in tracking
okay.
the opinion.
Yeah, I just want to say there was a third source of data, and that is we tried as much as possible to get indications of how the decision makers themselves reacted to the developing controversy. So we interviewed a number of people in and around Washington, and we also very carefully read the memoirs of Watergate. Sirica wrote a book, and several people in the Watergate prosecution force wrote books, and of course there's the Woodward and Bernstein. We read that, although I must confess that we it was an interesting book. We thought it was perhaps just a little bit too self-serving mm-hmm. In places, and we tried to cover really all of that and reconstruct, if I may put it that way, the kind of dialogue that was going on between the decision makers and the world out there. In fact, one of the sources of data that we use is we read through just about all the House Judiciary Committee proceedings in order to see to what extent were the discussions, I just mean the televised discussions, but the discussions they had internally before they went on the air, and we tried to pull out of every mention that they made to the public, how oriented were they to the public, and how oriented were they toward other issues.
So Gladys, let's just come right down to the nub here. What was the role of public opinion polls during Watergate?
They were the focus of all the actors in the drama.
Uh-huh.
They were the focus. It was important to the White House. It was important to the congressmen on both sides. It was important even to the people who were involved in the prosecution to follow the polls and to see just where the public was moving. They had to know just how fast they could move, how much they could do when it came to the pardon. The polls certainly played a very big role.
Somehow or other, I have this image in my mind, not to be too irreverent, of what Kurt calls opinion makers, the people in power, waking up every morning and rushing to the newspapers to see what they're going to think that day.
I think you're right.
Is that right?
I think you're right. I should tell you that
who's saying what, and what should I listen to? Huh?
Right. Well, it's they won't say that. It's what should I listen to?
Yeah.
And I think it's not. It wouldn't be fair to say that. But it's just basically that it's the old idea of not wanting to be. You want to be out in front of your troops, but you don't want to be so far out in front.
Well, a positive way to say that would be that these leaders wanted to make sure that they had, as you say, the people behind them. Is that right?
Right. They had to know what they weren't moving so quickly that they were going to have a reaction against what they were doing at all times. And of course, as far as the White House was concerned, one of their whole policy, if you want to call it that, their whole tactical scheme was actually to, it was important to them to look good in the public opinion polls. A lot of what was done was oriented to try to, Nixon felt that's what we called it, the battle for public opinion.
Yeah.
Because he felt that if he lost the battle for public opinion, then indeed he would be impeached. And so all through the time, his job was to try to get the public not to go along with the idea that it could be impeached, not even to allow the idea to enter people's mind that it was a possibility. So polls were very important to him.
Well, just to sum it up, I think as we put in our book, the issue always was, what will the public settle for?
Mm-hmm.
What will they accept? Now, you can impeach a lesser official, and it may make a story out of it, but nobody really cares. And so, but in this case, it was just, there's something almost sacred about the presidency, so you had to be sure that you were on sure grounds, and Nixon, of course, tried to play on that very sentiment, and that's what the battle was all about.
The program is Soundings from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond. You've been listening to a conversation about a new book by two scholars who recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. The book is The Battle for Public Opinion, The President, the Press, and the Polls During Watergate, by Gladys Engel Lang and Kurt Lang. The Battle for Public Opinion is now available in paperback from Columbia University Press. Gladys Engel Lang and Kurt Lang are sociologists at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about fiction of the modern American South. My guests will be two novelists, Liza Alther and Lee Smith. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.